Welcome to Women's Words, a program bringing you the written work of the women of Minnesota.
I'm Diana Hunter, a Duluth writer, and I'm reading from a memoir in progress about my back to the land and coming out experiences. This piece is called Why Not, My Not. In the shade of cottonwoods, I sat on the ground with friends from my softball team, passing one of the last languorous afternoons of summer vacation. I would graduate at the end of the school year, and knowing that, I wanted to hang on all the more fiercely to the present, even as I felt it passing, pushing me and everything I knew irrevocably toward change. A woman we knew from a rival team pedaled along on a bicycle and stopped to talk. She cut an elegant figure straddling her J.C. Higgins, tall, with lanky bones and hair in a ponytail set high on her head. I knew her as a pitcher worthy of respect and a student who excelled at regurgitating facts from textbooks. I also saw her as a pearl polisher who shined up to teachers, umpires, and anybody who wielded a little bit of power. The way she carried herself, a sort of upright self-awareness, gave the impression that my mom called snooty when we encountered it in clerks and professional women downtown or at our church. My mother operated a switchboard for the Great Northern Railway. My dad worked for the GN, too, as a truck driver who unloaded semi-trailers from flatbed rail cars and drove them around town delivering freight. They were both smart, but neither of them had ever been to college. They shared an aversion to putting on airs. The pearl polisher had hardly said hello before she announced in a giddy voice, "I was just at the school office, and guess what I found out? I'm ranked first in the class." Since we were girls and reared mostly by working-class people who used self-effacement and passive aggression as survival strategies, I'm sure one of us said, "Hey, good for you." I was still mostly taking it in when she looked straight at me and added, "Guess who's my second?" "I don't know," I said. "Who?" "You. And there's only 1/100th of a point between us." I don't know if it was the crisp, numerically precise way she put it or some nuance I heard in her voice, but for a minute I felt like a loser. The idea set in that maybe I should own up to being a pearl polisher myself, at least enough to earn those grades. Maybe the grades wouldn't mean anything in the long run of life. I knew even then that there were kids smarter and more talented than me who didn't get good grades because they didn't care or didn't try, but grades were a game I knew how to play. I knew they would mean a lot when it came to getting into an out-of-state college and earning scholarship money, and then it occurred to me maybe I'd earned my ticket out of Minot. The previous spring, when a petition supporting the Vietnam War circulated in my history classroom, I passed it forward without signing. The boy who sat in front of me turned around and stared. I still see in my mind his piercing blue eyes. Everyone who saw knew what I'd done. I was the only one who hadn't signed. This boy's dad was an Air Force officer at the Strategic Air Command base a few miles north of Minot. Our town was also ringed by Minuteman intercontinental ballistic missiles armed with thermonuclear bombs. Those 1950s economic development projects had come with lots of federal dollars and a big drawback. They put our town of 30,000 people on the map as a nuclear target. 40 years later, one of my teaching colleagues, an Asian historian who grew up in Iowa, told me that during the Cuban Missile Crisis, his father said, "If there's a nuclear war, we don't want to survive. We should drive up to North Dakota and go out in the first wave." On October 24, 1962, less than 2 weeks after my 13th birthday, the Strategic Air Command went to DEFCON 2, a state of alert that meant B-52s were launched and kept airborne, ready to go to war. While Kennedy and Khrushchev stared each other down, I told my dad I was afraid of dying. He told me, "Those missiles aren't all that accurate. They might aim for us and hit 15 miles away." I might have felt more comforted if I hadn't written school reports on civil defense, a euphemism at the time, for ways to survive nuclear war. I knew the radioactive fallout from a hydrogen bomb strike that close would kill us, even if the blast didn't. Maybe in some alternate universe we were all blown to radioactive bits. In this one, we got by alive but psychologically shaken. In 1967, the Vietnam War dragged on with devastating consequences on a smaller scale. One of our neighbors, whose son would soon be of draft age, told me, "We ought to just drop the bomb." "Where would we drop it?" I asked. "On the commies," she said. By Christmas that year, my cousin was in Vietnam with the 101st Airborne. His dad wrote to my parents and me, "We heard from Dick today. It's been close to 3 weeks since the last letter. He was fine and said his Xmas was as good as one can expect over there. He is in excellent spirits and stated he knows they are there to do a job. As I see it, these young men will be the strength of our country tomorrow, and certainly not the goof nuts that parade around with signs at our higher institutions of learning. I think we have a segment of our generation that protests just for the sake of protesting and trying to be different. The way some of them look, I'd say they were different. I didn't agree with my uncle about the protesters. I'd read about them and listened to them on TV, and I admired their courage. Mom and Dad agreed with him. After that, I no longer felt quite like I fit with my family. I thought I might be different myself. Even though I still admired them, I felt uncomfortable to let them know who I was. Like my dad, my uncle had gone off to his own war in the 40s. He served in the high-risk position of lieutenant in the infantry and was wounded in the Battle of Hurtgen Forest, a three-month-long slog of a fight that preceded the Battle of the Bulge. The Army shipped him home to recover, and my mother left her job at Boeing and took the train home from Seattle. She gave building bombers up to help my grandmother care for him. After the war, he became a special investigator for the FBI in Los Angeles. I thought of him and his letter often as I read Seth Rosenfeld's deeply documented account of J. Edgar Hoover and Ronald Reagan's conspiracy that branded student activists subversives in the 1960s. Based on 300,000 pages of FBI documents that Rosenfeld obtained through Freedom of Information Act requests, he laid bare the FBI director's and California governor's campaign to influence public opinion and governmental policy through defamation and disinformation. Surely, I thought, my uncle had been influenced by his boss's campaign. My parents thought he knew what he was talking about. For the rest of their lives, they believed he had received his information from reliable authorities. As for me, I set a goal of going to a good college, where I might meet some of those different people, someplace at least a full day's drive from Minot.
To listen to this episode again or subscribe to the podcast, and for more information about this author and her work, go to kumd.org and click on Arts. Women's Words is produced at KUMD by Chris Harwood. The assistant producer is Haley Westfall. Music by Sharon Isbin. Funding for this program is provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Women authors of Minnesota who would like to read their work on Women's Words are welcome to submit their writing via email to kumd@kumd.org.